Welcome to the Washington Defender Podcast. I'm your host, Pastor Brian Noble, CEO of Family Policy Institute of Washington. If you haven't checked us out, check us out at fpiw.org or fpiwaction.org. Do we have a special guest for you? We have an author and a true person knowledgeable about our Constitution and all things United States. So, Rick, welcome to the program. I'm glad to have you on today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, you recently have released a book called Money and Liberty. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about that? But before you get there, introduce yourself and a little bit about who you are.
Well, Rick Lynch, I'm retired, forcibly retired speechwriter for the federal government. Former Marine, born and raised in Virginia. And I've been on the Constitution subject for about 30 years. I've been delving into it. Started with a fortuitous conversation. It's amazing. You know, you go to college and so much of it is not good, to say the least. But there was a professor, American Political Thought, and one single sentence that he uttered one day started me on this journey. And 30 years later, I'm still on it. So
that's awesome. What was that sentence? Do you remember?
We were reading from a book. Oh, I think I have it here somewhere. We're reading from a book called The People Shall Judge.
Okay.
And basically it's 99% quotations from the founding fathers and the framers. That's two different groups of men, by the way. Every single living being on planet Earth conflates those two groups, two different groups of men. Okay.
All right.
Get that out of the way first. You cannot use them interchangeably. Anyway, and the quotations go back to English common law, et cetera, et cetera. If it had any bearing on American political thought, that quotation was in there. And I started to, you know, I was young and eager. I wanted to read all the exciting stuff about the Bill of Rights and all the stuff that would stir my passions and about my soul and blah, blah, blah. And the framers went on and on and on and on, and the founders too, about property.
Okay.
And I'm sitting there like, okay, I get it. You know, I saw Gone with the Wind, and I know that your property, your land, you know, I saw Scarlett's father's speech. It links you to your ancestors, and it reaches into your soul, and it defines blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, yeah, you know, all that stuff's a little outdated. You know, we care about our 401ks in these days and, you know, that kind of thing, the Dow Jones. And, you know, I also thought it was, you know, somewhat grubby, this attachment to your land. And then the professor... I was just getting tired of the word property. And the professor held up his finger and he said, remember, money is property. Hmm. And I've been obsessed with that idea for 30 years. So, and that's what
before we get into that, I want to go back to this. You've intrigued me, founder and framers. Like, help me understand that. Or maybe I'm even saying, let me say one more thing. I am very ignorant of a lot of this history because I was raised in social study years of the 1980s, which they didn't teach a lot of history. So I've been self-taught over the years. And so from my ignorance, just take me as a blank book, like you're educating me, Rick, and help me understand that.
It's a minor thing. I'm going to admit that right off the bat. Unlike many other of the myths I explode in my book, it's kind of minor. But and believe me, I mean, my God, you know, a Supreme Court justice, everyone gets it wrong.
Right.
Simple thing. The framers are the men who framed the Constitution. Mm-hmm. The 55 men who wrote the Constitution. Now, some of them are also founding fathers. If you Google it, lists differ. It's usually 6 to 8 people. You know, there's no official list. The framers is an official list. You were either there writing the Constitution or you were not.
Okay.
That's official. There's no wiggle room there.
Okay.
Founding fathers, Hamilton, Washington behind me, Madison, et cetera, et cetera. And like I say, lists differ. Some of those men, some of those founding fathers were indeed framers, but others, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, were not. They were not at the convention, had nothing to do with writing the Constitution. So that's the difference.
I see. Okay. All right. Thank you for explaining. Now let's go back into this idea of property and tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the framers, we can go property. That's fine. The framers, you read their words and their burning obsession with property. Just, it comes through as subtle as a blast furnace. I mean, it's all they talk about. And I have so many fabulous quotations. from other authors and the framers themselves. One author says that the framers viewed property with an almost religious respect. Mm. Well, there's nothing almost about it, okay? The framers believed in sacred rights from God, such mm-hmm. as the right to self-expression, freedom of speech, you know, rights of conscience, right? These rights are from God. But they also believed in the rights of property from God. In other words, and people understand this very easily, if I put it in this context, if you go out into the woods with an axe and you create a farm and you farm stuff and you raise pigs and chickens, et cetera, that property belongs to you. Mm-hmm. If another individual takes it, it is an affront to your God-given natural rights.
I see.
It's like, you know, if an individual comes to you and tells you who to worship. Mm. Property rights are sacred. As, and like I said, that author said, they viewed it with an almost religious respect. Another great author wrote, I didn't realize this, that for the framers, the top three rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of property, four of the framers disagreed with that formulation. But of those four, three of them put property number two on the list. It wasn't life, liberty, property. It was life, property, liberty.
Wow.
And of course, the book goes into it. Property is mentioned in the Federalist Papers. Mm-hmm. There's one single right, talking about property, tax, right, money, revenue. It's mentioned more than 17 times as often as the big three rights of the Bill of Rights. Free speech, free press, peace, whatever, the third one was peacefully assembled. So there was a burning obsession with property. And another fascinating thing about that, James Madison goes on a lengthy, John Adams has a wonderful quote. The moment the idea is introduced into society that property is not as sacred as the laws of God, anarchy and tyranny commence. At the convention, another great quotation from James Wilson, Pennsylvania delegate. I may be wrong about who said that. He's talking about America's first welfare program, the paper money crisis, that's chapter three. He said it was as alarming as the mark of the beast in Revelation.
Hmm.
As another author wrote, as I've been pointing out, the framers almost always speak of property in starkly religious tones. That's how they speak of property.
What do you think motivated that? Like, what was driving that? I know Samuel Adams, which is, he had a lot of background from a faith-based perspective. Yeah. But what was driving that for these other founders? And was it faith? Was it the Bible? What was driving that?
I think the philosophy comes from John Locke, mostly. He Scottish philosopher, 1600s. He was the most influential person on the framers. But no, it is faith-based. Hmm. In this day and age, I think all Americans accept the right, if you believe in God, that you have the right to a free conscience and you have the right to speak your mind and you have the right to worship. All Americans accept that. It's, I am telling you, I have found it amazing. If you accept the American credo that I have a right, a sacred right, to engage my life the way I want to engage my life, as long as I'm not harming others.
Right.
How is it, now you think back to the 1700s, how is it that that right doesn't include keeping what your labor, your body, your mind, and your heart and soul have created? Mm-hmm. You create property. And no one on planet Earth, no one has the right to come and take that from you. That is yours. I don't see how you could possibly say it's not as sacred as all the other rights. It's, why is it wrong to take it? It's the same reason it's wrong to take a life. If there is no God, okay, all bets are off.
Right.
Okay. There is a God. He doesn't want us to take, to steal from others. Now, I will say this, before people get the idea, because I get this a lot, before you get the idea that taxes are illegitimate, absolutely not. Taxes are legitimate, necessary, absolutely required. Mm-hmm. Property, like all of our rights in civil society, all of our sacred God-given rights, are necessarily compromised the moment we enter into civil society. I have a right to protest the government. I do not have the right to pull up with a sound truck and a bullhorn in front of the old folks' home at 3 a.m. and protest the government. You don't have that right. Right. I have a right to self-defense. I do not have a right to take my fully loaded machine gun and lay it on the defendant's table in front of me as they read the verdict to me in my murder trial.
Right.
All rights are compromised when you enter into civil society. Mm. If you wish to rise above the dreaded state of nature, where life is, I'm sure you've heard, nasty, brutish, and short, you must have government and you must pay for it. So taxes are legitimate. However, all our other rights in civil society, we believe, should be compromised this much, only when necessary and only minimally. You can't just say, well, you live here and you will follow the rule. No, no. You, all the rights we believe should be compromised that much, only when necessary and only minimally. There seems to be this belief when entering into civil society, however, that the federal government can take every single penny that you ever will make for the rest of your life and spend it on any darn thing that they want at any time that they want. People will call that, admittedly, they will say, well, that spending is wasteful. They'll laugh at it. They'll point out how ludicrous it is. You've seen the stuff that Doge has uncovered.
Right.
You know, $8 million to teach journalists in Sri Lanka how not to be offensive. Gay Sesame Street in Iran. People look at that spending and say, ridiculous, outrageous, wasteful. But how many people call it what it is, a violation of your sacred God-given rights? The framers certainly would have called it that. John Adams had another wonderful quotation talking about if we were to create a democracy, a pure democracy, which of course we do not have, we have a republic, and everybody just gets to vote on everything. You know, his first worry is what is going to happen to property? And he says, again, these starkly religious tones, straight from the Bible, he says, you will find that property will be as the lamb committed to the world. Now, in the Bible, the lamb is Jesus.
Right.
And in
right.
John Adams' quotation, the lamb is money.
Right.
That's just how seriously they took it. And I'm sorry, maybe I've gone on, but when you say, where did it come from? If you go back to the 1700s, it's not like today. It's, I mean, your property keeps you alive.
Right.
And you spend, can you imagine what it's like to be a farmer in the 1700s? The endless backbreaking toil, the labor that never, ever, ever stops. And at the end of the day, you don't get a Mercedes-Benz. I mean, you get enough food to stay alive.
Right.
So I think it back in that day, it's much, much easier to see that property is not just, you know, your money's not just something. So that's where it came from.
When we think about property, did the founders and you can say no to this, but it seems like the idea of taxation on property tax, let's say, versus taxation on commerce purchases or, you know, spending of goods, it seems like, you know, I've met a lot of elderly people and even myself, like my property tax is more than my first house I bought.
Yeah.
So the first house I bought included property tax as well, but that payment for the first house, the house I now have, the property tax alone is more than that payment was.
Yeah.
So we really, in the end, don't own any property. I mean, the fact is that we're renting from the government. Thoughts on that? Did the founders talk about that, or you know, how is tax to be collected and property not to be disturbed that way?
Well, back in the day, it was, first of all, the federal government, when the federal government respected its limitations, which is a different, that's the Bill of Rights chapter and something. When it respected its limitations and we respected the enumeration, the federal government, you know, except in times of war, spent, you know, 2% of GDP, 2%. Now we're up to 25%.
Wow.
And there was actually in the Constitution, there's direct taxation. And people have argued over exactly what that means. Direct taxation was forbidden. In other words, the vast majority of all the taxes collected were tariffs and duties and that kind of thing.
Right.
No, I think, because it never came up, I can't say for sure, but I think the framers would have been horrified at the fact that, yeah, it's basically illegal to own land in this country. You rent it, as you said. Many people have pointed that out. And I think they would have been terrified of that. They've been horrified of that subject. But it would never come up because the federal government spent, In inflation-adjusted dollars, the first Congress, in inflation-adjusted dollars, the first Congress, I think, spent $2 of yours. That's in inflation-adjusted. Now it's $20,000.
Wow.
It would not have been an issue because the framers wrote the Constitution such that 99.9% of everything that the Leviathan spends your money on today, all of it is unconstitutional. Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, welfare, that's 60% of the budget right there. Unconstitutional. They can't take your money and give it to somebody else. It's just that simple.
Right.
And certainly it was unconstitutional to send your money to journalists in Sri Lanka to teach them to not be offensive.
Right.
So yeah, I think it would have been repelled by such a thing. But it's hard to, I can't, there's not much on it because it never happened.
Right. You know, it's interesting because I think you know this. I've been a pastor for 30 years, and I always describe the role of government as two basic functions, very simple: safety of its citizenship and to punish evil, from a biblical worldview. That's just the two core basic. Everything else falls out to the family and or the church, right? So like taking care of the widows, taking care of the orphans, all that falls into the church realm and or the family realm, depending on
The
the context.
100% true. The under the original Constitution, we haven't touched on that yet. That's the enumeration. That's a whole another subject, which we can go there now. But under the enumeration, the federal government secured the border, raised an army, defined and punished piracy,
Right.
had a postal system. That's it. I mean, very mundane, boring things.
Right.
The federal government had no authority to engage in anything that it does today. Just it did not.
Right. And would that include local government, like state government? I mean, we're a state organization. It seems like I live in Washington State, and I think you're in Washington, D.C. But anyways, it seems like our state at least has way exceeded its boundaries. And I would even say, okay, I'll give you shared resources like roads and fire departments. I mean, I'll throw that in, even if the Bible doesn't quite mention that. But we'll throw that in. But it seems like, man, we have gone to some very extreme things on property and taxation and environmental worship and all those kind of things.
Yes, the government has a book. The government can take everything you own for any reason whatsoever. Now, state governments, now this is where people get real upset about this, and you can't blame the framers. The states were left largely to their own devices, and the main reason for that, the states did lots of things the framers didn't like. They did it then, they're doing it now. But you have to understand, people don't get this. People think that, the British were gone, now we have to create a new government. The Constitution came 6 years, the convention met 6 years after the final defeat at Yorktown. So it had nothing to do with that. But actually, I digress. At the time of the convention, we had 13 separate states, and they were all basically separate nations. They paid $0 to the central government under the Articles of Confederation, except on a voluntary basis. They were separate nations. Now, here come the framers going to create a more solid, cohesive union, not just a loose confederation. Okay.
Right. A
So
united,
I'm sorry.
a united union.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So the people in the states are very, very, very nervous about this, and rightfully so. They've got their own nations, they're happy with their own little separate nations for the most part. So you're going to create a federal government that has, oh, what powers? So the framers were very, very, very clear on this. And the Federalist Papers make it crystal clear. Look, this federal government is going to secure the border, declare war, have an army and a navy, settle disputes between the states, et cetera, but your internal politics are left to you. That's your beef, that's your business. Again, I guarantee you there are lots of things the states did the framers weren't crazy about, but they really had no power to change it. If they'd have come in and said, we're going to start messing with your internal powers, your internal police powers, the states would have said, no, you're not, we're not ratifying this government. It's not going to happen. So the states were left free to do a lot.
Wow.
Back to property, though, because this is a very, 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 very important point. I think maybe the biggest point in the entire book. And boy, you want to talk about getting into the biblical side. The states were free. Most people don't realize this, separation of church and state. That was a federal concept. The states were absolutely, completely, totally, 100% free to have state-supported churches. The last state-supported church did not disappear in America until the 1830s.
Wow.
There is a quotation in the book explaining that the states had absolute internal police powers. The state was authorized to suppress free speech and suppress the newspapers and to pass sumptuary laws, which are laws telling you what you can eat, drink, or wear for the purposes of moral or religious instruction.
Wow.
That's how much internal police powers were left to the states, unaffected by the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. This is big, though. The thing that the states were no longer allowed to do, think about this for a minute. This is how the framers viewed property. They could tell you what to eat, wear, and drink. But under the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, limiting the state powers, the states are no longer allowed to print paper money. And that's because paper money was a welfare program designed for no reason other than to allow people with debts to cancel their debts, to steal from their creditors. The paper money crisis, it's one third of the book, because the welfare crises, the paper money welfare crises, is the reason the convention was called. People with debts in a variety of states, Rhode Island especially, were printing paper money in order to steal from their creditors. And if you want to go down that road, the laws that they passed and the things that they did were breathtaking. And the framers said, this is a nightmare. This is horrible. This is blatant theft at the point of a government gun. But wow. that's how they viewed property. State-supported church, no problem. Paper money, not a chance.
So what is the concept, or what is the main point that you believe that most of us get wrong? It sounds like some of us are elevating some of the Bill of Rights versus the understanding that the, I may use the wrong term, framers.
Yep.
Framers wanted a focus on property. Is that what I'm hearing you say, or what?
Okay.
Correct me on that.
No, that's fine. So the Bill of Rights, here's chapter one of the book, the single greatest thing.
And do you have the book? Can you hold it up for people?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
If you insist.
Yeah. There you go. So it's Money and Liberty, and check it out. It's by Rick Lynch, and check it out. I believe it's everywhere, right? Is that accurate?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So you can go.
Money down. And Liberty, how the framers' obsession with protecting your money shaped the Constitution.
Okay.
And again, the Constitution was written only because of the organized theft going on in the states. But here's the first thing that people get wrong about the U.S. Constitution. And for some people, this is going to come as an incredible shock. And I'm, you know, I quote Robert Bork, gets it wrong. Everybody gets it wrong. The Bill of Rights. At the Constitutional Convention, they're writing the Constitution. Someone proposed a Bill of Rights, 55 men. The men who wrote the Constitution said that the Bill of Rights was, among other things, unnecessary, preposterous, and dangerous. The state delegations at the convention, therefore, rejected the idea unanimously. Everyone thought it was a bad idea. The Bill of Rights has absolutely nothing to do with the framers, nothing to do with the founding fathers, period. They thought it was a bad idea. Why did they think it was a bad idea? This is very, very significant. The framers wrote the U.S. Constitution, and it already had a Bill of Rights in it. Okay, let's go over this. The framers said it was unnecessary and dangerous. Let's take unnecessary first. There was already a Bill of Rights in the U.S. Constitution, a much, much better Bill of Rights. Now, you might think that tearing down the most cherished artifact in the entire history of the world would take, you know, a great deal of words, a great deal of thought. It'd be complicated, be Aristotelian in its depth. Nothing could be farther from the truth. Nothing could be more breathtakingly simple than the reasoning the framers rejected the Bill of Rights. They had a Bill of Rights in the Constitution. It was called the Enumeration, Article 1, Section 8. These are the powers of the federal government. Notice the difference. Well, here it's a better idea. Instead of listing the rights of the people, because who said, instead of listing the rights of the people as the Bill of Rights, enumerate all the rights of men, exclamation point, I am sure, sir, that no gentleman in the late convention would have attempted such a thing. That's James Wilson. You can't have a Bill of Rights, because if you try to list our rights, it would be 10,000 volumes, and you'll leave something off. The framers had a better idea. Article 1, Section 8. Here, we're not going to write a little list of your rights, Pastor Brian. We're not going to do that.
Right.
We're going to write a little list of government power. Article 1, Section 8. The federal government can secure the border, raise an army, establish a post office, have post roads, tax, sets up tariffs, blah, blah, blah. A short little list of federal government power. Anything not on that list is retained by the people. On that list, you will see no power to seize your guns, to tell you who to worship, to support your neighbor, to send money to Sri Lanka, to send money to Iran. You do not, as a matter of fact, every single thing listed in the Bill of Rights is already protected by the enumeration.
That's really a deep thought. You know, I guess I never really thought about it.
Section 8, no one ever did. Well, in this day and age, I need to be super clear about this. I have never in 30 years of talking about this, never in my life encountered one single human being ever, not one, who is familiar with the enumeration. Zero. I've read books where people are familiar with it. G. Gordon Liddy used to be on the radio and he was familiar with it. He talked about it all the time. I don't know if you know who he is. He was a conservative talk radio, G. Gordon Liddy, Watergate fame. But no, I have never in my life met a human being who was aware of the enumeration. It is infinitely a billion times better than the Bill of Rights. The enumeration gives the federal government 10 powers. All other rights and powers and authorities in the world still belong to you. The Bill of Rights gives you 10 powers and everything else belongs to the government. I have two quotations from Madison and Franklin Pierce, another a president, and they're both talking about welfare in one form or another, and they both say the exact same thing. I cannot undertake to place my finger on that part of the Constitution that enables me to spend this money for this purpose. They went to the enumeration, and Pierce was looking for authority to spend money to assist drought-stricken farmers. If you read the enumeration, you will not find that power listed. You will not. And Pastor Brian gets to keep his money. If you go to the Bill of Rights, which is what every single living, breathing soul does today, and you say, and what you'll do is you say, I'm going to read this list. I'm going to look for it to say, I can't spend that money. Here you go with your Bill of Rights. The government shall not establish a religion. Okay, I can spend Pastor Brian's money. The government shall not take your guns. Okay, I can spend Pastor. See? Right. Under the enumeration, the government could spend your money on virtually nothing. Under the Bill of Rights, the way it's misunderstood, the government can take every single penny that you make and send it to Sri Lanka.
Right. You know, it's interesting because the my understanding of the founders or the framers. Framers. There we go. I was like, wait a minute, I'm going to get this right. Is that the fact is they believe that the charity should come from the heart. So if I wanted to give to the farm, you know, the farmers who went through a drought, that's my own free will to do that from the heart. And it was like, they didn't assume where right now how it is. It's like, it's not from the heart. It's just, you got to pay your taxes. Otherwise you have the IRS knocking on your door or the state knocking on your door and then they get to spend it however you want. So what I'm hearing you say is they embraced that charity idea or benevolence or whatever word you want to say, and from a free will perspective versus a forced perspective.
Yeah, there's absolutely nothing. I mean, by God, people say this 1,000 times a day. There's nothing charitable about taking my money at the point of a gun. You know, I give up the money or I go to the federal penitentiary. It's that simple. That's not charity.
Right.
It's just not.
Which, if you liken that to faith, you know, like I would say most Christians, 99% of us believe it's the fact that you have to come from your heart, right? You got to come to the Lord freely, and it's not forced by the by a gun or whatever else. So this is interesting. So how long has this book been out? Is it something that how can we get it to people? How can we educate people? That kind of thing.
Well, it's been out since the 9th, and it's available everywhere. So
okay,
and I would urge you to. Let me see if I can get this
in there. It's there Money and Liberty by Rick Lynch. And so pick it up. It's been out since, I believe he meant September 9th. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, September 9th. And so we'd love for you to grab that. I know there's a number of other podcasters who watch this. Get Rick on your show. Let him talk about this as well.
Please do.
That's us. So we're in this episode, we're going to stay on the idea of property. You're just putting so many concepts in my mind that I just never have thought of. Like when you said in the enumeration, they had 10 limited powers, and then
not 10. I'm sorry. It's a short list. I believe the federal powers, I numbered them at 29. And in the Bill of Rights, you've only got 24.
Okay. Okay. Wow. Yeah, I've just never. I mean, you're turning it upside down, which I've done a lot of governance training, and there's like the Carver model, and there's other models of governance, and some are like this is what you can't do, but you can do everything else, and some are like you only can do these things, and so you're spurring in my mind just a number of thoughts of how we've gotten out of alignment with our Constitution and with the original intent of it,
and that's why, remember, the framers said unnecessary. We've covered that, and I think we've covered dangerous. The problem with the Bill of Rights is, as the framers said over and over and over, why it's dangerous, it's misread. The framers said this: if you list certain rights, you create the impression that is all the rights. And that is what I have never, ever in my life met anybody who didn't believe that. They believe that completely. Can the federal government take your money to establish a Department of Education? Read the Bill of Rights. Nope. They can't take your guns. They can't do this. No. Federal government can take your money and send it to Sri Lanka.
Right.
Because of the Bill of Rights. Here, if I can, one quote, let me read you this from the book. This is what the Bill of Rights did. The Bill of Rights was not merely a bad idea, a bad change, like, say, prohibition. No, it went beyond that. For it introduced a strategy for protecting liberties that was entirely different from the strategy designed by the framers. Not only was it different, it completely undid the framers' strategy, obliterating it completely. As we shall see, these two visions, the Bill of Rights as protector of liberty versus the unamended Constitution as protector of liberty, are mutually exclusive. They represent, with mathematical precision, exact and precise diametric opposites. One is the antithesis of the other. The system of protections the framers gave us is not diminished by the Bill of Rights. It is not marginalized. It is utterly and absolutely destroyed. The two visions simply cannot exist side by side. Placed in proximity to one another, one of these visions must die. And indeed, one did. Again.
So, and I think we should be clear. You're not saying that we shouldn't have freedom of speech or we shouldn't have freedom of those things. But you're saying if we limit it just to those things, then it opens a can of worms for all other things that we shouldn't be involved with. That's what I'm hearing you say.
Thank you very much. My wife actually pointed out this to me. The framers believed passionately in free speech, everything in the Bill of Rights. They believed in it passionately.
Right.
And of course, as I mentioned, under the enumeration, those rights were protected.
Right.
100% protected. They believed in those rights passionately, but don't list just those because now that's all you've got.
Right.
That's it. Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
That's the only rights you have.
Yeah. Wow.
So no, I'm sorry. Yeah. They were passionate believers in those things.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing. Another great thing. James Madison goes on and on and on defining property rights. Think about it. He defines property rights as the right because you have a property in and of yourself. That's why property is sacred. Your body, mind, and soul create the property that you have.
Right.
If I'm reading spreadsheets 40 hours a week and I get paid, my body, mind, and soul, if I'm a homesteader with an axe, okay? So you have a property in yourself. And he said that the rights of property include all the rights of conscience and the rights of religion and the right to be your own person. James Madison said this, every single thing that we worship today in this country as the rights of conscience, I have a right to do what I want as long as I harm no others, is already included in the term property rights. It's a little side note that I'm on here. For the framers, property rights included the rights of conscience. It's no accident, however, that they called it property rights and not the rights of conscience. Somebody in this modern age has done a very, very good job of believing in property rights and ramming it down our throats, but leaving the property part out. because, well, politicians don't like that property part. So politicians love the Bill of Rights. They don't care, you know, for the most part. They don't care if you, you know, worship a tree stump or, you know, whatever kinky weird thing you're, they don't care. Just keep the checks coming.
Right.
That's what they care about. Keep writing those checks and, you know, do what you want. So
what would you say would be a, you know, obviously get your book, educate yourself, become informed about this, and then do what? What can we, as an individual citizen or a Christian or a Christ follower, what can we do to embrace this concept?
Well, that's a tricky question. Well, you start by educating yourself, and then you try to educate others. I don't know if it's I just don't know if I don't know if it's a lost cause or not. I hope not. But but you know, I remember, like I said, G. Gordon Liddy had a very, very popular radio show for at least 20 years. And he talked about the enumeration an awful lot. And yet still I've never met a soul who knew anything about it. And I've never met a soul who especially sees the contradiction between the enumeration and the Bill of Rights. You know,
yeah,
that's what can you do? You can educate yourself and try to educate others. And you're in, this is your forte. Is that about the size of it?
Yeah, no, I think it is. And I think what we need to do is when we're evaluating people we're voting for or levies that we're voting on or bonds that we're voting on for our school districts, we need to evaluate first and foremost. The government is not owed that. Like sometimes there's like this guilt thing that's put into a community, like, hey, if you don't vote, all the teachers are going to starve and be fired, right? You know, kind of thing. And the reality is we're self-inducing, you know, tension into our hearts, but also for others, because we, you know, these taxes don't come from nothing. They come, we vote them in oftentimes, we say yes to it, but we don't think about the impact of our widows, you know, that, and that really gets me. It's like, you know, so there's a small portion that votes no, and they can't afford their own property. Or we don't look at the impact of, you know, the single mom down the street who now can't hardly get gas because it's so overtaxed. Or, I mean, and there's just a number of ideas and that whole worldview of property is mine. It's what I've created, whether it's intellectual property, whether it's physical property, whether it's, you know, something tangible or something else. I love that concept. And I think that's where the education begins to motivate and inform us on how to vote, what to vote for, and to be informed in that way.
Yeah. And you need to realize, and you just touched on it, you know, Locke, you know, forget John Locke, forget the framers, forget the founders, forget philosophers. Does it not strike you as true, because this comes from Locke, forget him though, does it not strike you as true that when you labor to create something, okay, and if you believe in God, and God gave you your mind and your heart and your soul and your hands, and if you labor to create something, that thing is yours, and it is a part of you. Mm-hmm. And when somebody takes it, they are taking a part of you. This is in the book. Right. You know, these people, my body, my choice, my right, you know, from abortion people to anti-vaxxers, you know,
right.
They might actually realize this, you know, I can't bear coming across people who pretend that they couldn't care less about their money. And, oh, it's, you're lying. You're like me. You wake up every day for 40, 50, 60 years of your life. You're working 40 hours a week and blah, blah, blah. Don't tell me you don't care. Everyone does. You know, I met a billion people who couldn't care less about their money. Maybe one person actually meant it, you know?
Right.
But when they take your money, they are taking a part of you.
Right.
And, you know, again, that came from a philosopher, but, you know, I believe it.
Yeah. I do too. And that's, and even that individual rights that, you know, you just mentioned the unborn baby is, you know, that's God's workmanship in the womb. And it, you know, so that's why we don't have the right to end that, you know, we don't have the right to take that. And, it, you know, at least he claims in scripture that he wove us together in our mother's wombs. So, you know, I just think that, I've never really thought about property and those, and that overarching right. And the enumeration, I really want to go back and read that myself sometime more closely and use that contrasting concept that you were just doing. That was very insightful.
I'm sorry, go on.
I was just going to ask you, any other closing remarks or things that you'd like to say?
No, on the enumeration, you'll read it, and thankfully, fortunately, it's quite boring. The government may establish post roads, and then blah 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 blah. You know, it's mundane things. And James Madison said that. He said that the federal government is not going to be a concern of the people. It's not going to touch the people's lives on an everyday basis. The federal government will be active and visible in times of war. Other than that, you know, it's not going to. And it was that way for a very, very, very long time in this country. A very long time. You know, the states reign supreme, and the federal government, if you're at war, okay, you're going to hear from us. Other than that, they don't touch your life.
Was the concept like, let's say if I'm in Washington and I'm like, oh, my state, it doesn't represent my values. I'm going to go somewhere else, to a different state. And was that the idea of freedom of movement? And
yes, indeed. And people have written extensively about that. That's one of the great federalism is created by the enumeration. The concept of federalism is created by the enumeration, because it says, here is the federal government and its powers, and here are the state, you know. And many, many people have talked about this. It's a great and wonderful thing when you have all these states doing their own thing, the laboratories of democracy, a laboratory of democracy, this works, this doesn't work, da-da-da. And if you don't like things, oh, so many people have written this, yes, you can leave. I mean, it's a burden to move from Texas to Massachusetts or vice versa. But what's the burden when the federal government, I write about this in the book, when we trash the enumeration, you know, we've turned the federal government into this, they're identical now. I mean, what are you going to do when you don't like, you got to leave the country. If you don't like what the federal government's doing, you got to leave the country. And there are states that I would never, ever, ever live in. Mm-hmm. And I live in Virginia, and I'm sure there are lots of people who would never live in Virginia. Fine, right. Beautiful, wonderful. But what happens to those people who don't want to come to Virginia when the federal government starts looking exactly like Virginia, or or vice versa? They look like Texas or Massachusetts.
Right.
And then what are you going to do then? Right. Federal government is never meant to, tell us, how much water our flush toilets should have, and what size engine I can have, and how much my car can weigh, and the gas mileage, and my light bulbs, and blah, blah, blah. No. No, yeah. And on and on. Right. I mean, Hamilton, right. I did I mention Hamilton? Somebody said, you know, we should build a network of roads for military purposes. Look what happened, you know, the War of 1812. We'd had some roads, it'd be real handy, blah, blah, blah. And Hamilton says, good idea. You'd have to amend the Constitution to do it, though.
Wow.
You'd have to, even that, you'd have to amend the Constitution to do it. So, well, Alex, how about we send $10 billion to Sri Lankan journalists. Are you down with that? I'm thinking that'd be a bridge too far.
Right.
Probably.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. We like to inform people from different perspectives and different ideas of where they are. And I really do hope, as we live in, for us in Washington State, as we defend and advance biblical values here, that you will begin to think as a Washington defender, I'm voting on this bond. I'm voting on this levy. I know it's coming up. And am I taking someone else's property, the money that they've earned, and and redistributing that to someone else? What am I doing in this situation, in this decision? Because it's easy to blame the federal government. It's easy to blame Olympia in our case. But the question really is, what have I done to empower and enable that? And so I hope people will reflect on that as well. So,
at the end of the day, it's 100% completely the people. The people, you know, I have fallen asleep. The people will get what the people want at the end of the day. And, you know, sometimes I'm not all that optimistic.
So we're going to have you on again. Give us a little teaser what we're going to talk about next time.
Well, I think we've covered certainly paper money,
right?
Because I promise you, it's as weird as it sounds, certainly paper money, because I think we've done property and the Bill of Rights. The Constitutional Convention was called for one reason and one reason alone, period. The framers had a lot of concerns about the Articles of Confederation, a lot, but none of them. There was no crucial spark. Without the paper money crisis, there would be no Constitutional Convention. You know, the framers
Give too much, because we want people to come back. So if you want more information about that, we want you to tune in next time and check out Rick's book, purchase his book, hold it up one more time for them so that they can see it. We would love for you to get this purchased. Money and Liberty. I think they also have a Kindle version if you like that as well.
Yeah. Hardback, Kindle, this, that. The only thing I'll say on Paper Money, it was a welfare program. And the framers are absolutely horrified by it. And that's why the Constitution was written.
All right. So check out, we'll be putting up Rick here in a couple of weeks and get the information out. So as we like to say around here, go out there and defend and advance biblical values in the public square. God bless you.
You love our beautiful state, but does fighting for issues that most affect families ever feel like you're climbing alone? It can feel like an uphill climb in a hostile environment that Champions causes detrimental to Washington families. Again and again, the summit feels out of reach, but you don't have to climb alone. With like-minded people fighting for Washington families by your side, the journey becomes not just possible, but powerful. The Defender app, brought to you by the Family Policy Institute of Washington, connects you with your team for the climb ahead. Connect with conservatives who care about issues affecting families in your specific county and across our state in order to make our voices be heard locally and in Olympia. Simply click Learn to stay informed about the latest news affecting families. With one click, press Huddle to team up with other conservative minds in your specific county who care about how these issues affect you and your unique community. Then simply press Activate to get involved and to make your voice heard on legislation that matters in Olympia. With the Washington Defender app, you won't face the fight alone. Together, we can make a difference for families in Washington. Download the Washington Defender app today, a simple way to let your voice be heard